Welcome to All the Smoke, a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio in partnership with Showtime.
Welcome back, man. Season 2 of All the Smoke.
We got a real special guest.
What's up with you, Brody, with the virtual handshake?
I'm going to tell y'all something that I never told nobody.
I want All the Smoke.
Welcome back to another edition of All the Smoke. Jack, what's going on, bro?
My brother, what's going on? Just chilling. It's getting kind of cool out here in Atlanta, but I'm warming up.
Yep, as you should. Man, I'm chilling out here. We just had the birthday with the baby a little while ago, so he's two
Ash,
now.
Even
though he looks like he's fucking four, but we had a good time with that. Hung with the family. But, man, we got a special one today, a legend in the space.
Hall of Fame edition.
Yes, absolutely. Welcome, Jim Gray, to the show. Jim, how you doing?
Great, Matt. Good to talk to you and Steven. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. I mean, over 40 years in this business, tremendous accolades, more memorable conversations. Before we get started, when I was doing research on you, Muhammad Ali had an amazing quote that kind of just like really kind of contextualized like what today was about to be about, and he saw it early. The first interview Jim ever did was with me. From then, the first to my last, and many years later, we have a very special relationship. I'm the greatest. He's the latest. Jim is the me of his profession. Just don't tell Howard Cosell. Like, when Muhammad Ali says that about you, how does that make you feel?
Well, it feels as good hearing you read it as he did when he said it, as I've read it 2,000 times. He was a special man. He was obviously very special in my life, the first interview that I ever did, guys, and allowed me to be the last interview that he ever did on television. So to have been able to travel with him, to learn all that wisdom, to hear all of his stories, to be in his company on so many occasions, to have seen him fight, what he stood for outside of the ring, the principles that he had, the man that he was, the fun that he made it. He just made it so much fun. He loved people. He loved all people all the time, and he was great with kids. So when I hear that, Matt, and when you say it, I still literally do get chills because coming from him, I mean, I just can't get higher praise or what could make you feel better than that?
From a greater person, absolutely. Like, it just kind of it made me say like, oh wow, like that was very special. How is current day treating you? How different has it been during this pandemic from your normal day to day? Because you're so active across the board in several different sports.
Well, just haven't traveled much. We stay to ourselves. You know, you miss the people tremendously. You miss the people that you work with, your friends, your family. Unfortunately, my mom has got stomach cancer, so I want to be able to see her. So we've really isolated. I live in California. She lives in Colorado. She's doing good after a number of chemo treatments. So it's just kind of altered everybody's life and changed so much for everybody across the planet and here in our country with the tremendous loss of life. Those who are isolated, who can't see people, the unemployment situation and loss of jobs and the economics fallout from it. So, you know, I guess we've just been impacted like everybody else. You know, certain areas we're doing good because we're home and we're safe. And certain areas, you know, we're trying to help other folks who are struggling and just trying to get through it, knowing that, you know, it's no longer a 24-hour news cycle. It's a 24-second shot clock, and you guys can understand that better than anybody.
Wow. Well, we're sending love and strength and prayer to your mom.
Thank you.
Yes, for
hoping
sure.
She pulls through this.
Thank you. She's 89 and she's strong. She's tough. So she's doing the best she can with the hand she's dealt. She tells me all the time that coronavirus and the isolation is much more debilitating than the stomach cancer. So I guess that's good news,
wow.
But it's also, you know, just want to make sure that we can get her through this period and be able to spend some more time with her after this vaccination hopefully gets rolled out and people can get back to whatever would be considered a semi-normal life.
Absolutely. You just released a book that I can't wait to read this past November, Talking to GOAT, Spotlighting Conversations and Time Spent with Some of the Biggest Athletes, from Kobe Bryant to Muhammad Ali, Tom Brady, LeBron James's Decision, Mike Tyson, the Dream Team, Pete Rose, and the list goes on. When you sit back and kind of look, and maybe you can't have a full perspective yet, because I couldn't get a full perspective until I was done playing but just kind of looking back at your path to today and still going as strong as ever, what do you think? Like, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
How did all this happen? How could this have possibly happened? Because you don't really reflect when you're doing it. I mean, you both played, 14 seasons in the NBA and traveled to a number of teams. Well, I was there chronicling a lot of that and just going from city to city, doing interview to interview. And then when you start to look back and reflect on this, and I had Greg Bishop from Sports Illustrated, who did a great job organizing this and writing this book. He was terrific to work with, and he's a great writer and a great friend. But there's tens of thousands of interviews and events, and so much has gone on that while you're in the mix, you're not really looking in the rearview mirror. And this caused me to look in that rearview mirror. And I'm sure, you know, Matt, when you saw a lot of those highlights, or Stephen, when you look back at your careers and you see all those baskets that you made, or the critical shots, or the big defensive plays, or those huge wins that you didn't think about when they happened, maybe you did for the moment until the next game.
Right.
And then you start taking a look at this and the collection, all of it, and you say, wow, how did all this happen? And then you start thinking, I really did all that? And so, it's been a real blessing. And it's been fun to look back, particularly when, you know, I used to live at John Madden's house and became very close to John Madden. And he's a genius, a brilliant man, obviously, with football in his coaching and then broadcasting and all the Emmys and analysis and then the Madden game. But Madden used to always say this to me: everything in life is looking forward. When are you born? When are you going to crawl? When are you going to talk? When are you going to walk? Where are you going to go to school? What are you going to be? When are you going to have confirmation? When are you going to graduate? Where are you going to college? So I can keep going on and on and on all the way through a lifetime. But you're always conditioned to look forward. Very rarely, at least in my life, have I been thoughtful or conditioned to looking backwards. So this gave me that opportunity, and it was fun. It was hard, but it was fun.
Mm. Speaking of the book, me and you had a chance to previously speak about your book. You was telling me about it, and it's something that kind of involves me in your book.
Well, The Malice in the Palace. Yes, sir. I was there that night broadcasting that game on ESPN with Bill Walton and Mike Breen, and I was standing right there when you kind of jumped over me and went in there with Ron.
A memorable night, man. A memorable night, for sure.
Probably much more memorable for you and all the repercussions and everything that has gone on since. But, you know, it was interesting on a number of levels. And, you know, to be able to reflect on it. And, you know, there's some interesting things I try and put in the book at The Malice at the Palace that, you know, really hadn't been examined. And a couple of the things really is I blame personally, you know, the Pistons, not only their fans, but Ben Wallace much more so than, you know, the public did and seemingly, you know, everybody did. Obviously, you can't go in the stands and start fighting with the very customers who are paying for your game.
No question.
So, and what David Stern did was exactly right. But the blame and the reason all this began, really, in my estimation, began with Ben Wallace and got taken to another level with the fans.
Right. Yep. The game was over.
Well over. I mean, you know, I believe Bill Walton even said on the air that wasn't even a hard foul.
leave it to Bill. I love Bill. Ron uncut. So you've had obviously, as we spoke, a 40-year career that stemmed over several sports: basketball, baseball, boxing, football, golf, you name it. Do you have a favorite? Is there one you tend to, or you have a love for all of them?
I really do have a love for all of them, and it's kind of hard when you're sitting at a Super Bowl to sit there and think, boy, wouldn't I much rather be at the NBA Finals right now? Or if you're at the NBA Finals watching Jordan make a shot, or LeBron, or Kobe, you're really not sitting there thinking, boy, the opening ceremony of the Olympics would sure be nice to be sitting at. So you're kind of just, you know, really fortunate and lucky to have been able to have the whole collection of them all. I will say this, though. There's nothing like a great prize fight. When Hagler and Hearns, or Tyson and Holyfield, or Ali and Frazier, or Mayweather and Pacquiao have that ring walk, there is an energy and an intensity that is in the air in that arena that doesn't really exist. Maybe only one other thing exists like that, and that's the lighting of the torch at an Olympic opening ceremony. You know, who will light it? How will it happen? Will it be a bow and arrow, which was brilliant in Barcelona? Will it be the greatest moment I ever saw with Muhammad Ali, you know, fighting Parkinson's? And there was the greatest who lit the torch. So perhaps that moment. But no, really, I don't think I have a favorite sport. I mean, I love basketball. I love the NFL. I love boxing. And golf has been a lot of fun. So, and the Olympics have been just tremendous. So my favorite sport is the one I think I'm at the time I'm at that place.
There you go. Like you said, lucky enough just to be there. But then I think what is obviously allowed that you to have the success you have and the longevity is trust. And as players, it's hard to trust the media. It's very hard to trust the media because it's normally angles. And I remember from the first time I met you, and then, like I said, prepping on this and as a part of your book and what they said, and a lot of the common theme was like they trust you. You know, you're a straight shooter. You're honest. There's no motive. Even if you have to ask the tough question, it's still, you know, there's no unwrapping to do. And that says a lot about you because, like I said, for athletes, it's almost like a criminal talking to police. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like it's hard sometimes because your words get twisted and it becomes different than what you intended it to be. So we really are almost really protective when it comes to actually talking about you. So for these guys to be as comfortable as they are to talk to you and let their guard down, it really says a lot about you as a person as well.
Well, thank you. And it's I've been honored and really, you know, gratified by what these folks have had to say for the book and about me. And, you know, trust is a hard thing. How is it that you and Stephen trust each other? Well, you do. You build a relationship. There's a camaraderie. There's a coexistence. And you understand. And you don't have to probably talk to him every day to understand that he can be trusted and vice versa. So true friendship and true relationship, guys, it's reciprocal. I can't just go put my arm around Kobe Bryant one day and say, I'm going to be your friend and you can trust me. Like you said, you know, there's a tremendous amount of distance and distrust that goes on. So it has to be reciprocal. So if somebody's always giving, that doesn't work because then there becomes a dependence, right? And if you're always giving to somebody,
right.
That dependence is going to become debilitating. So the giver is going to be resentful of always giving, and the taker is going to become a dependent, so that doesn't work. So it has to go back and forth. So I've been fortunate with a number of these guys, from Ali to Eric Dickerson to Tom Brady, currently to Kobe Bryant. You know, I was really heartened. The first line in the book was from Kobe. And, you know, it just says exactly how it is I've tried to behave in my life. If I had one word to describe, he was talking about me, Jim Gray, it would be that he's honest. Well, my dad taught me that. He said, it doesn't cost you anything to tell the truth and to be honest. I've tried to live like that. And you know, fortunately, it's worked.
I know we're virgins compared to your career being in this space. But I know the conversations we've had in a year and a half, you know, with just the guys that we play with and the people we look up to, it means a lot to us. You know, you talk about the Kobe conversation, you talk about the D-Wade conversation, a lot of conversations we have with guys, they mean a lot to us. So I'm just sitting here thinking about the people you had conversations with, the meaningful conversations and the names you've named. I mean, I know that has to hold a big part of your life when you're sitting at home just watching TV or having breakfast, just thinking about those conversations, because you've talked to some of the best in the game, the best to ever come around.
It does mean a lot, and it means a lot internally, and it's nothing externally, because, you know, when you've been doing this for a long time, and it's a different day and age, as you guys very well know. I mean, back when I started this in the 70s, nobody even had a beeper. If you didn't answer your home telephone, that's why I got to go interview Muhammad Ali. I was the only one in the station. I was an 18-year-old videotape editor, a sports intern, okay? Well, nobody answered their home telephone. There was no beeper. There was no cell phone. We were all walking around with computers in our hand and documenting every moment. So that led to that. But it also led to really being able to have a relationship, being able to prove to somebody that you were trustworthy. You were able to connect with people because, for example, you know, the players who are great today, they walk in and they're sitting at a podium and they come in from behind a curtain and then they exit from behind a curtain. Well, that doesn't That doesn't allow for there to be a transactional type of circumstance where you're actually in front of somebody where you can laugh, you can smile, they see you're human, they understand that you might have children, they understand that your car broke down, or you might have a different empathy toward them, toward missing a basket or throwing an interception, because you can see it and feel it in their being, in their presence, in their eye, as opposed to now, you know, it's at a distance and everything's at a distance, or somebody can just text it out or tweet it out or put it on Facebook. So that distance grows. So when you have a relationship truly with somebody, I mean, you guys have been in locker rooms your whole life. So you know what's public and you know what's private. Well, that used to be how we covered teams. We covered teams with what was germane to what happened on the field of play. So if you did something on the field of play, that was fair game because everybody saw it and everybody knew it. Then if you did something off the field, which spilled onto the field, if you did something that became into the public's eye, that affected your play, that was fair game. But all of the rest of this wasn't being documented by the microsecond under a microscope. So, you know, it didn't come into the purview of what some guy was doing at night, what some guy was doing with his free time, where he was eating, what car he purchased, how he might have treated somebody in a bad moment of his life, not his best moment, but a bad moment, but had nothing to do with the game. Now everything is just fair game because everything's out there. So I was very fortunate and feel really, really good about the time that I was able to come up in this because it allowed for all of this to occur. I don't know that it could now.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, Jack and I think have been able to be successful in this space is because it's almost like we're with the old rules. You know what I mean? We're not looking for clickbait, negative clickbait. We're not looking to cause division anywhere. Like, we genuinely want to be able to humanize our guests / friends and learn about them. You know what I mean? I just get just as interested in, you know, hearing what they have to say than I know our fans are going to be, because even though I know them, we're getting them to a level where it's not our normal, you know, it's a normal no cameras type feeling, but just a sit down conversation where they can feel like they can let their guard down. And I think that's what's most special for our viewers and our fans when we're allowed to do that for them. But the one thing too, I mean, it almost seems like to me now, because Jack and I are in the media space, you know, I don't blanket everyone, but to me, it seems like it's about being first now and not necessarily right. You know what I mean? And when you're wrong, when the media is blasting you for something that is sometimes false, it's headlines. But then when we find out that, okay, well, you know, someone reported that wrong, it's just a tiny blip at the bottom of the newspaper or just on the bottom line. What do you say to people who kind of see it like that and people who are involved that feel like that?
You know, you're exactly right, Matt. And I do a chapter on that in Talking to Goats. It's called Upon Further Review, which is a famous statement because everybody hears that all weekend long when they watch the NFL games, you know, when they go up to the instant replay. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, now in reporting, instant replay gets further and further and further away. And the rush to be number one seems to be, you know, the omnipresent, be pervasive, and seems to be so important. And I tackle a few of the things in the book, which were my personal experience and the pressures that occur. And one of them was Richard Jewell in the Olympic bombing. And I was on NBC all night with that for the Atlanta Olympics. And here was a man whose life basically got destroyed. It became a movie last year by Clint Eastwood, directed a film about Richard Jewell, and he had passed away. But, you know, the rush to judgment that he was the Olympic bomber just permeated and took over. He ended up winning lawsuits against several news organizations, but his life was destroyed because of that, because he wasn't the bomber.
Right.
It was Eric Rudolph who had done that, but that destroyed his life. Then we had the rush to judgment with Deflategate and ESPN coming out with information that was all wrong, that set the tone, which led to a $25 to $40 million investigation by Ted Wells about literally the amount of a fart being let out of a football, somehow changing the outcome of a game that was, you know, they could have played with pillows. The score was like 45 to whatever it was, 10. I mean, it was ridiculous, the score. So, and they spent all this all time right. and energy because they had the wrong numbers that was given out. And then that took on a life of its own. And we learned more. What did Bill Belichick say? He's learned more about PSI than any human being should possibly know. And it led to, you know, everybody knowing about, you know, gas laws. I mean, nobody even thought about this stuff. It's a football game, for crying out loud. It had nothing to do with the outcome. But that rush to judgment,
right.
you know, really right. negatively affected, you know, Tom Brady and his mother. Unfortunately, Galen got cancer. And is it related? I don't know. But stress causes all of this stuff. And just to be put through that. And then people think you're a cheater for life. Okay? And, you know, so right. those were two instances. But exactly what you're saying. And I think, Matt, people come on your show. And I watch your show. And you guys are terrific at this. But you know why? It's because of your ears. Your ears will never hurt you. You guys are willing to listen. And you're willing to let your guests have their say and talk about their stories. And it's always about the other people's stories. It's about the people who are being interviewed. It's their stories. It's not the other way around. And, you know, unfortunately, there is a rush to judgment. We see it just across the landscape, and things have changed. And so now nobody knows exactly where to get their news from or what source is correct. So it's problematic.
So what was it like covering the NBA in the 1990s?
It was a great time. I mean, we had a lot of great people who were playing the game then. I mean, the 80s were a tremendous amount of fun, too. I mean, I learned so much on the coattails of Dr. J, Julius Erving, and he opened up so many doors. And prior to him, it was Marvin Webster and Paul Silas and them opening those doors. And so the 90s gave way to that era of Michael Jordan and those six championships that he was able to win, and the Pistons and the Bad Boys. And Chuck Daly was my best friend. He introduced me to my wife. He was my partner when I first started broadcasting back in Philadelphia on a regional station called Prism. And Chuck had been fired by the Cavaliers. He was fired by Ted Septian, who was the owner, and came back and did the Sixers broadcast, the pregames and halftimes with me. So I was able to have a tremendous insight because of Chuck. And so that was just it was a fascinating time. And obviously the 90s also gave way toward the end, toward the rise of the San Antonio Spurs and Tim Duncan and David Robinson and, you know, the end of that era and Magic and Bird had bowed out. The Dream Team was part of that, which caused this tremendous explosion for global basketball, for America exporting this game. And now all of the countries that participate and all of the players who come from these countries, all because of Jordan and the Dream Team. And there was nobody more fun to cover and to be around than Charles Barkley during all of those years. He made everybody laugh. He kept it fun. He was obviously a tremendous player. But it was just a great era, to answer your question, Stephen. It was, you know, every time you turned around, there was a good game. And it was a fun game. And Karl Malone and John Stockton, and who could ever forget Jerry Sloan and Rudy Tomjanovich. Rudy Tomjanovich and the Houston Rockets. Rudy Tomjanovich treated so many of us so well for so long. I'm so happy that he's going into the Basketball Hall of Fame, the Naismith Hall of Fame. And he was just wonderful. You could listen to his huddles. You could come into his locker room. He would answer any question. He trusted everybody. And I say this about Tom Brady.
Yeah.
And this applies to Rudy Tomjanovich. Tom Brady trusts himself so he can trust other people. Mm-hmm. So if you make a mistake, you hang yourself. You're your own noose. If you get cut or get pushed out, it's because you screwed it up. And that's how Rudy Tomjanovich was. Everything was fair game with him, and he would tell you anything. Decide how you want to use it.
Right.
Speaking of Tom Brady, what is it like? You guys do a radio show together. What was it like, two goats, you and Tom Brady, working together on your guys' show?
Well, he's the accomplished goat. He's the one that's thrown all the touchdown passes, but as he would be quick to say, he doesn't like that moniker with him because, A, he's still playing, and, B, he's got a lot of great teammates, and it takes the other 10 who are on the field with him and then the other 11 when he's off the field. So those 21 other guys play a big, big part in any success that he would have. But to do the radio show with him has been a total joy. The fact that he is, in my opinion, the best quarterback to ever play and the best player in the history of the National Football League, that he makes himself available every Monday night for more than a decade for the pregame and halftime, analyzes the games, answers all the questions about football. If there's something off the field that's important, he's willing to go in and answer those questions. So to have that access and to have the guy, he's become a friend and a good friend. And I'm honored that he wrote the foreword in the book and that he has been willing to partner with me for all of these years. And so, you know, what's it like for you guys when you were able to play with Kobe or against Kobe or when you're in the presence of Jordan? You know it's special. Mm-hmm. You know it's unique. You know that they're special. And you know that they have done everything that it takes to get to the absolute top step of the victory platform and stay there. And he stayed there now for 20 years. And still has a chance this year, in a new place with a new environment. So I've learned so much from him football wise, but I've also learned a lot from him just as a human being. And if you can't get along with Tom Brady, and if you have a problem, and let me tell you, 30 cities have a problem with him. There's a whole lot of hatred toward Tom Brady, not because of anything that he has done, other than beat the teams in those cities. So if you're outside of the New England area or outside of Tampa Bay, you know, everybody's railing against him. But if you spend 5 minutes with him, or if you have a relationship with him, if you can't get along with him, you better take a good long look at yourself.
You come from an era, obviously, starting when you started your career, where great players, you know, stayed with one franchise. What was your thought when Tom Brady left New England for Tampa Bay?
Well, you know, Tom's father, Tom Sr., he calls himself the original Tom Brady. He said this about 4 or 5 years ago. He said, "It won't end well here. It never does." And he was able to look into the future, having known what happened to Montana in San Francisco, where they live. He knew what had happened, you know, with Joe Namath going, obviously, leaving and coming to the Rams from the Jets. He had seen it with Wayne Gretzky, and how he went from Edmonton, where he was a legend, to Los Angeles, and then on to New York. And so, you know, the landscape is littered. Michael Jordan ending up in a Washington Wizards uniform. So you just see what happens, and it's so rare when it's the Kobe Bryant circumstance. And so sports rarely ends well. And, you know, so I was saddened because, you know, everybody wants a storybook ending and you want your friends to be happy. And I wanted Tom to be happy. And then I figured out the more that I talked to him and the more that he let me inside, happiness was being able to leave at this time, not with any bitterness, not with any rancor, not with anything but gratitude. I mean, so much is made out of this. I mean, he came there as nobody and he left revered, the most revered football player in the National Football League.
All time.
So he's not angry with those folks. Might it have been better from moment to moment? Of course. Nobody spends any time with anybody, let alone 20 years, and has it perfect all the time. There's always bumps in the road. But he's grateful.
Right.
He's respectful. And he's happy with that time that he spent there. But he had to go, just like it seems like the organization figured that they had to let him go or move on. And so he went to Tampa. That's where he picked. His family's happy there. They have a chance to win football games. It's not like playing in New England where he threw the ball to the same people with the same patterns and the same, not the same people, but the same system for 20 years and whatever that is. How many baskets did you guys shoot? Maybe a million? So he's thrown a half a million passes to these guys. And now he's going to a new place with a new coach and a new organization. And you can't expect after, you know, 12 weeks, 14 weeks, 16 weeks, whatever it is, to have the same connection and chemistry as he had at the place where the other stuff had gone on in 6 championships. But as a human being, he's very, very happy, and he still wants to compete, and he still has all that left in him. So I think it was with a lot of mixed emotions. In the book, in the Talking to Goats book, he called me before he made his announcement, and we were on FaceTime, and he had written 2 beautiful letters, to the organization and his teammates, and 1 to the fans. And when he read the 1 to me, to his teammates, and to the organization, he started to cry. And it was just such a beautiful moment because you could see just how much it had meant to him, how difficult it was, but how relieved also after the tears had flown he was, that this was the right time and the right thing for him to do.
I mean, they raised him. I mean, similar to Kobe, you know, going there at, early 20s or 20 years old, they saw, you know, obviously his progression as a man, not only as a player, but as a man, too. So I can only imagine all the emotion attached to leaving. But like you said,
it's
well documented that it rarely.
I hate to interrupt you, but just think how close he was to pulling the plug and asking Dr. Buss, get me out of here, because Phil Jackson wasn't treating him right. And he couldn't get along with the circumstance that was going on in the organization. So it was just this close. And Dr. Buss, who was a brilliant guy, you know, urged patience. And, you know, he was a great poker player and he was a great basketball owner and a brilliant guy, a genius of a guy. He just said, hold on here a second. And it all worked out, and it ended up working out great for Kobe and the Lakers.
Absolutely. Pivoting, you mentioned earlier there's nothing like the energy of a prize fight. What got you into boxing?
Muhammad Ali. I was an 18-year-old in my edit booth. They were converting from film to videotape. So all the film guys were in the union, and they took the buyout. They didn't want to learn a new craft. So I was 18 years old, the University of Colorado, and they hired me to be a videotape editor, hired a bunch of young men and women. And so I was in my edit booth editing the Broncos with Red Miller show. They were getting ready for the draft, and I was there at about 7 o'clock in the morning, and in came the assignment editor running in, and she said, you know something about sports. You were the sports intern, and you edit all the sports videotape. And I said, yeah, what's going on? She said, Muhammad Ali's 2.5 hours early at the airport. Go interview him. I'd never done an interview before. It was the first interview I was ever being asked to do.
Wow.
So I didn't have any clothes. I went into the weatherman's office, tried to fit on his stuff, but it was too small. He was a little itty-bitty guy named Stormy. And so I just ended up getting in my car and running out there. But you got to understand, they couldn't find the news anchors. They couldn't find the sports anchors. They couldn't find reporters because nobody picked up their home phone at that hour. They were either asleep or they were at breakfast or out for a jog or in the shower, whatever they were doing. So I went out there and I saw Ali, and we went into this little room at Stapleton International Airport, and I asked the first question. And he said, you're doing this interview? And everybody in the entourage started to laugh. Well, that laughter made me laugh because it was funny. And I wasn't ready for this interview. And it relaxed me. Instead of seeming like he was making fun of me, it was funny what he said. By about the third or fourth question, he said, you sound like the local Howard Cosell. And let me tell you guys, that was the best. Matt and Jackson, Stephen, that was the best compliment I'd ever had in my life. Okay? And that just propelled me with confidence. So I came back to the station. He gave me 45 minutes. And I was going to edit my...
A whole nother man, though, I'm sure. Not to interview you, but you came back a whole nother man. Like,
I was just on cloud nine. This was the most famous guy in the world, a sporting icon. I had watched all of his interviews my whole life with my dad, with Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell. So I went to edit myself out because they weren't going to put me on the air. I wasn't an on-the-air personality. I was an 18-year-old editor in college. So as I was editing myself out for the evening news, the head of the bureau walked in, the news director, a man named Roger Ogden, and he watched this tape with me for an hour and a half. He watched the 45-minute interview twice. At the end of it, he looked up at me and he said, I'm putting you and this video on the air. It's barely adequate.
Wow.
So I tell everybody I've been barely adequate ever since, and here we are. But that led, back then they had this thing called, it was an ABC station, and ABC had this thing that was called DEF, ABCDEF. DEF stood for Daily Electronic Feed, and they would feed out everything from the local stations to each other. So all of the ABC affiliates would get this. So they uploaded mine on the Daily Electronic Feed to all the other ABC stations. Well, almost all the stations took it down and put it on their news because here was a young kid interviewing Ali. Well, that got back to Ali that it was a big success, the interview, and how he had treated me. And so he started letting me come to all of his fights from then on and interview him before the fight and after
that's
the fight.
So
and
dope.
So
holy
ABC
shit.
Took notice of that, and my boss took notice of that. And then Bob Arum hired me because he saw that Ali had opened the door. So if Ali was good with me, then he started letting me interview Hagler and Hearns and Duran and all of his big fighters, that Sugar Ray Leonard. And so that opened the door, and then Don King saw that. And then so Don King and Bob Arum, who were big, big rivals, both hired me, and I was just a young kid, and they would bring me in before their big closed circuit fights to do all of the interviews for that week. Well, back then, you know, there wasn't, they didn't have stuff like we have now. So this was a right. way that every station in the country could get material without having to pay to put a reporter there. They'd get all of these interviews. And so it just opened all of the doors so it's Muhammad Ali to answer your question. It was a long answer. I'm sorry.
All good. It was a great answer. I mean, before we move any forward, I mean, to kind of hear how it started, can you explain to our viewers where all those beautiful statues are behind you?
Well, those are all the Emmys.
This
is a glove given to me from Muhammad Ali. There's the great Nelson Mandela. Yeah,
beautiful.
That's my wife and my dog, Fran. My dog name is Rave. Yes. My wife is Fran. There's Muhammad Ali and Frazier. And there's my big hero. There's my big hero right there, my dad. And he passed away. And there's my mom. And she's in Denver. So that's everything that, you know.
Nice.
And there's the colonel. There's two pictures of the colonel. I call him the colonel. Jack Nicholson. Colonel Nathan
Jack
Jessup.
Nicholson.
There
I
you
got
go.
It.
Hey, he's got a nickname for you, too, doesn't he?
Scratchy.
Doesn't Jack Nicholson have a nickname?
Scratchy.
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 Getting back to where we were at.
And there's Ali and Frazier. Ali and Frazier. There you go.
Yeah. I saw the Ali in the corner. Yeah, I could see that. How different were Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson first as fighters, but then as people as well?
Totally different on all ends. Totally different in almost everything that they've done in their lives and the way that they've approached it. Both great fighters. Mike Tyson was seek and destroy and was powerful and, you know, had a huge intimidation factor and would go into the ring with the, you know, with just that brutal towel over him and those black
black laced shoes
and, you know, kind of stalk back and forth and walk around. And Ali was much different in his style, in an elegant robe with a beautiful, pretty face. And I'm so pretty and I'm the greatest of all times. And, you know, his approach was different. His body language was different. His skill level was different. So Tyson is a brilliant man. OK, Mike Tyson is really, really intelligent. I mean, he has Arthur Ashe on this shoulder in Days of Grace and Chairman Mao on this shoulder, and he can recite the tenets of the Red Book, and he can tell you about history and Napoleon and Shakespeare, and he can go up and down all the lineage of boxing, and he has tremendous wherewithal and is really, really incredible. And then Ali, obviously, you know, Ali was Shakespeare. Ali was a poet. And he was fun. He was eloquent. He was boastful. He was principled. He was all of those things that we look at and we hold in such high admiration and aspire to. And Mike, there's just so much to respect as well. You know, Mike Tyson at his worst moments, Matt and Steven, at his worst moments, he comes out and faces the music and he answers the questions, particularly with me. And I've always been grateful for that. He's not hiding behind a press release. He's not hiding behind some PR spin. He's not saying, my lawyer will handle that. He's not saying, let the Nevada State Athletic Commission decide what happens and then I'll release a statement. He comes out and he takes his own medicine. And Mike wrote me a letter when he was in Indiana in the youth penitentiary in the correctional facility in prison. And it came to my house in Atlanta. And it had already been opened because the warden or the prison officials, I guess they do that so that they make sure that whatever's leaving the prison is okay to be viewed or to be seen. And so I got to the second page and the letter said, they'll let me out of prison tomorrow if I'll admit to this rape, but I'll never admit, Mr. Gray, to something that I did not do. So I'm going to stay here in prison. Next paragraph. However, there are four or five other things that I've done throughout the course of my life that are worse than what I'm accused of. Therefore, I feel I'm at the right place at this time. Wow. So he got out of prison and he let me do the first interview with him when he got out of prison. And I said, Mike, is this a personal letter or can I make it public? If you don't want me to say this, I won't. But if you do, then I will. And he said, you can ask me whatever you want. It's not a problem. So I asked him, what's worse than what you were accused of? And he looked over at his lawyer. He looked back at me. Then he looked into the camera and he said, you know, it's probably best not to answer this on national television because I don't know the statute of limitations. However, what I wrote you is true. I was in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Powerful. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So they're much different people, different people, but they're both great in their own right. But nobody will ever be like Ali. Ali was, that's why he's on top. He is the GOAT. He invented it. And for what he did inside and out of the ring, in all aspects, Ali is by himself.
The way Tyson started off his career, like, and just think about how he was in his right mind, how he was guided by Customato, he had a good camp, the right people with him. How much greater could Tyson have been?
Probably could have been much greater. But he fell. He fell prey to all of the vices, and he's not regretful of it, but he spent all that money. He enjoyed his life. He did all those things that he wanted to do with women and drugs and to satisfy any personal need for that moment. Any need he had to have pleasure, he just went for it. And so he's not regretful of it because he would be the first to tell you, I lived the way I wanted to live and had a great life. And if that meant having tigers in his house or being bitten by the lion, you know, he was doing what he wanted to do. Or if it was in his quiet moments, which he still has now with the homing pigeons and you know, where he takes so much solace in that. But he was diverted mentally by all of these distractions. And you saw it play out in the ring because you can't play boxing. Okay, it's a serious sport,
right,
and everybody
right.
who's coming at right. you is serious about it. So, you know, he was playing too much with the very thing that brought him all of this attention, all of this money, all of this glory. And so, yeah, I'm sure he could have been a lot greater, but I don't think that he would tell you that he would change much of it. In fact, I just did an interview with him for the book, Talking to Goats. We had an hour special, and I asked him specifically about some of those things that he doesn't have regret for. And he said he probably would bite that ear all over again if that's what happened to him. So he's had a long time to think about a lot of this. And, you know, the great thing about Mike is, you know, the stuff that is in the rearview mirror, he doesn't try and deny it. He says, you know, that was my glory. And even if they were despicable and bad acts, you know, nobody was going to take my glory. So you know, I've always respected that he wants to own what it is that he has done and try and be better with how he goes forward than he has been in the past.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm a big Mike Tyson fan. I'm getting a tattoo of Mike on my.
Yeah, I'm a huge Mike fan. Wow. Being someone who had the opportunity to really get to know him outside of just these interviews, was it something that from a distance you saw coming when you kind of felt like he fell from graces? Was it the Buster Douglas fight or was it before? Like it was a culmination of things adding up? Did you see anything as, first of all, a friend, but second of all, as your job in this space, like,
Matt, you could see this coming from a million miles, and you didn't have to be Nostradamus. You know, you didn't even have to have a crystal ball. You knew that this was going to happen. You just knew that the way he lived his life with the wave of emotions and the roller coaster that he lived on, and you know that juiced him up too. That used to make him great. And I've often thought with a lot of these great athletes who perform these incredible skills, if you start altering that very being that they are, and you try toning him down in this area or making him more polite in this area, or if you just alter whatever it is of those guys, if you didn't tell Michael Phelps, hey, you know what? You've been staring at a black line almost your entire adult life to figure out how you could get an eyelash or a fingernail to that end board first. If you started telling him to do something other than staring at that black line for the countless hours, days, months, and years that he did, Well, he wouldn't be the most decorated gold medalist in the history of the Olympics because you would have altered that.
Right.
So if you start altering Mike what he was, he might have not had that ferocious response that he had that made him great, that made him all have the entire world want to watch him. So you could see it coming and you knew that it was going to crash, but that was all part of the beauty of it. You know, nobody's attracted to calm.
Right.
Everybody is attracted to the hurricane. Mm. We all tune in to see the damage that the hurricane does. Nobody really looks outside when it's sunny in 78.
You had an opportunity to obviously get to know Mike and Muhammad Ali in their primes. And I hate to put you on the spot because obviously this is all speculation. Who do you feel like would have won a fight when they're both in their prime?
Ali, I think he proved that against Foreman. So I would say Ali. And the good news is Mike, he says it right here on the back cover, so he won't be mad. He said, I'm his most trusted friend, so he would understand that, and I think he believes that too. So don't come calling and screaming at me, Mike. He wouldn't do that. But no, I believe Ali.
To see Mike... Back in
what
the
do you guys think? Let me ask you that
ex-
question. I'm gonna. I know it's your. I know it's your show. You're asking the questions. But what do you guys think?
I think Ali got a little bit too much for him. I think the same kind of problems Lennox gave Mike. I think Ali would have gave him times 10.
Matt, what do you think?
I agree. I mean, my only thing is if Mike could have got obviously inside, which was tough to do, but got him on the ropes inside and hit him with an uppercut, that's going to put anybody to sleep. So that would be my only, you know, thinking. But, you know, as far as just straight boxing, to me, I've never seen. Obviously, I wasn't around in Ali's prime, so everything I had to go back and watch. But from what I saw, I don't think anyone, when Ali was on his game, I mean, he showed that no one could beat him.
What are you, Matt, like 42, 43?
I just turned 40 in March.
Okay. Oh, those UCLA days went quick.
Yeah. Man, didn't they? Yeah, I'm 20 years, you know, it goes by fast. It goes by fast. I had my 20-year high school reunion, and I'm coming up, man, in 2 years, I'll be my 20-year college. I'm just like, holy, it's going by too fast.
So, Steven, how long are you removed from there?
40, I'm 42 years old.
Wow.
42 years old. Yeah. I've been out the league, going on 5 years now.
I'm 3 removed. Yeah, it goes by fast.
It goes by fast.
Longevity is key. Thoughts on Mike? One last thing on Mike. Thoughts on Mike getting back in the ring? We just saw an exhibition against Roy Jones. I think Mike held back a little bit on some shots. He probably could have really hurt Roy. But to see after everything he's been through, good, bad, and in between, to see Mike back out there, because it looked like leading up he was really enjoying himself training and just kind of getting, because you heard him talk before that he missed that. So to see him back out there, what did that mean to you?
I thought it was a terrific night. It was fun. He'd lost 100 pounds. He had rededicated himself. He hadn't found that in him since, you know, he had quit on Showtime. We did that fight against McBride. Where he just said, I can't be this person anymore. I don't have it in me. And then to be able to see what he did a couple of weeks ago against Roy Jones Jr., and he didn't try to hurt him. He understood that it was an exhibition. Right. And, you know, as Snoop so eloquently said on the air that night, put some sauce on those ribs, please. You know, he hit him pretty good to the midsection on several occasions. But he didn't want to hit him in the face. And Roy did very well. I mean, Roy's 51 years old, and he stood in there. And you could tell he was exhausted, but he made it through. And he acquitted himself well. So, you know, I was happy for Mike, you know, that at least he came out there and was able to accomplish what he set out to do. And he gave the fans, and he gave a whole new generation at least the ability to see him in good shape and to go into the ring. And I'm sure it'll set up for him to be able to do this again. Who that will be, I'm not sure where that will be or how that will go. But it was a tremendous financial success. It was a tremendous physical success. And they pulled it off in these COVID times, and everybody who tuned in seemed to be happy. There don't seem to be a whole lot of complaints, and we get a lot of complaints in boxing. We get a lot of people who don't like what they see, and I haven't heard that, and as well they shouldn't. I thought it was an excellent exhibition, and that Mike looked terrific, and you know they're going to score this thing a draw before they start because the Athletic Commission in California doesn't allow you to score an exhibition. So the three celebrity judges who they had are doing it off of television, and I'm sure it was all, you know, set insofar as they weren't going to announce a winner, but anybody who watched the fight could clearly tell that Mike dominated.
Seeing that exhibition, just hearing that Floyd announced that he's going to be fighting, I think, Logan Paul, what, as someone who's been in the game from Ali to Tyson to seeing Floyd's greatness throughout his career, how do you feel when you see arguably one of the greatest fighters of all time fighting a YouTube star?
I'm never one that says somebody shouldn't do what they want to do, because only they know how they feel. So only Floyd knows how he feels, and this is what he wants to do, and he feels good about it. So whether or not the public will buy into this or want to see it, that's a whole different equation. But I think that, you know, we live in a place where you are free to go about and do what you want to do. So this is what he has determined he wants right. to do. He feels that he'll make money doing this. I guess he feels that he'll have some fun. Mr. Paul is one of these guys who obviously has a tremendous following on social media. His brother Jake just knocked out Nate Robinson the other night, and he is committed himself. I don't know what Logan is in terms of boxing, but younger brother or brother Jake has decided that that's the profession that he wants to pursue. So, look, Floyd's 45 years old. He hasn't really fought. The Conor McGregor was an exhibition, really, as well. It was a huge payday, and it was a fight that goes on his record. And then he ended up with Berto after that. But I guess, you know, Floyd wants to stay active in a minimal way and do this. And who am I to sit here in judgment and say, no, don't do that. This isn't good. It's not good for you. It's not good for them. No, I don't believe that. I believe it's fine if this is what he wants to do. Let the public decide. Let the public decide if they want to see this. Let boxing fans decide if they want to see it. And sure, go ahead. And what do you guys think?
I think it's great.
I think it's great. I mean, I like it. Like you said, you can say what you want, but at the end of the day, people are going to tune in. And that's why I think overall stuff like this happens, because people do want to see this. And I think too often media or people with the platform will critique situations. Like Dana White came out and kind of took a stab at what the state of boxing is with this. But I kind of feel like if everyone just listened to what you said and thought how you thought, the whole world would be different first and foremost. But, you know, stuff around sports would be different. Like, you, to be an athlete, we have, you know, a small window to be as great as we can, accumulate as much money as we can. And when it's over, it's over. You know what I mean? So for Floyd to be as great as he was, no blemishes on his record. Like you said, 45, it's still going to be a cool little payday. And like you said, minimal work, because we all know what's going to happen. I see nothing wrong with it.
He's Floyd Mayweather. He can do what he wants. As long as it conforms to with what's in the law, why not? And he's been a fighter his whole professional life. Wants to have an exhibition? Great. I mean, the people have their choice. If you want to watch it, you're going to watch it. And if you don't, then you'll move on to something else. And guess right. what? It will attract a lot right. of attention. He's Floyd Mayweather. He's a perfect 50-0. Yes. Right. And apparently this other young man has a huge following of young people. And so that's going to attract mm-hmm. attention, and we'll see how it collides.
Everybody want to see Logan get knocked out. His brother just TKO'd Nate. Knocked Nate. He knocked Nate under the ring. They're probably still trying to wake Nate up. The world want to see Mayweather get knock Logan out just for revenge. And that's just what it is. So people want to see it because of that. Let's just keep it real.
It'll be interesting if Floyd takes the same path that Mike did and doesn't want to hurt the young man. Because Floyd Mayweather is one of the greatest fighters in the history of boxing. And he didn't lose all of his skills and all of his talent because he hasn't fought for a couple of years now. He will have all of that. Right. So I'm sure that he could do great damage to this guy. The question is whether he will have mercy and let him be, or whether or not we will see it unleashed.
Jack, what do you think? Should he have mercy or unleash that shit?
Unleash it, man. Hey, I feel like this. Hey, because just think about it like this, though. If he lands a good punch on Floyd where it dazes him anything, he's going to live off that for the rest of his life. So Floyd, go in there and knock him out. Don't play
One
with
of the
it.
First fights I got to You're go right. to was Ali against Alzado. That's why he came to Denver for that interview. He was going to fight Spinks, and then he was going to fight Lyle Alzado, a Denver Bronco, who went on to win a championship with the Raiders. But they had that at Mile High Stadium, and Ali clowned and played. for Alzado, he wanted to land a punch and he wanted to actually hit the champ. And so it was serious for him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't obviously win the fight, but it was something that was more than an exhibition to the football player and obviously nothing but an exhibition to the boxer. So it'll be interesting to see what type of approach Floyd takes on that.
Okay, GOAT. What was it like to cover two other GOATs, Shaq and Kobe?
Well, it was fun. I mean, Shaq made things so much fun. I mean, Shaq was a brilliant basketball player who you know, obviously was a big guy. And like Wilt Chamberlain said, nobody loves a giant. So everybody used to beat up on Shaq, and he used to have to take it from the referees and take it from opponents and so forth. And but Shaq's a big, lovable guy, still is to this day. And but there was a personality conflict with Kobe because, you know, they each felt that, you know, it was their team. And obviously Phil Jackson was involved in this. And, you know, Shaq was a much more sensitive guy. So Kobe got beaten up upon and it took a toll on Kobe. And it set him back. You know, it didn't necessarily shake him in terms of his ability to move forward and continue to achieve greatness and want to be the best basketball player of all time. He was myopic in that view, but it wore him down. And so, you know, they didn't have an appreciation. Shaq didn't have necessarily an appreciation of Kobe until it was too late, until him and Phil had beaten him up so bad that Kobe just wanted out and wanted away. And because he wanted away, and they figured that it was better for Shaq to move on. You know, when he went through that diatribe with me in the interview that we did, Kobe had a tremendous amount of venom. And one thing I think that, you know, having been his teammate, Matt, and then, you know, having that famous thing where, and you saw where he didn't flinch when you were with the Orlando Magic. One thing about Kobe was myopic, and he just wanted to win. And if you were in his way as an opponent, mm-hmm. he got you out of the way. And if you were in his way as a teammate, guess what? He treated you the same way. He got you out of the way. Right. And he did the same thing with Phil. He had total disdain for a long time with Phil Jackson. He despised him. And even Phil wrote in his book that he could feel that hatred coming from Kobe. Now, they ended up fine, and they ended up winning more championships. And they patched it up later in life as they moved on. But Kobe was certainly distracted and distraught with that treatment. And so when he gave that interview, I had to tone him down. I said, Kobe, we can't, you know, and it's in the Talking to Goats book. I said, Kobe, if I put this on the air, there was one statement in particular. I said, first of all, you'll never, ever have any kind of a relationship, let alone win championships with this guy and this organization. Mm. But you'll also have a hard time just going to work every day. I said, we'll let the rest of this go because they're your words, not mine. But the one statement that we took out that I said, Kobe, I'm editing this out. I said, not only for you, but for me, I have to have a relationship with Shaq. He said that Shaquille O'Neal, he was referring to, he said, the guy selling donuts at the 7-Eleven had more pride in his job than Shaq did. And this was the same interview that he had gone public calling him fat and lazy and that he had surgery on the organization's time and he would do it on company time instead of his time, why he wasn't ready for the season. And so, you know, it was volatile enough without that. And for the next two or three years, Shaq, I called Shaq before this interview came out to give him a heads up because I really like Shaq and I enjoyed covering him and we had a terrific relationship and he didn't want to respond. And then it came out and he threatened to kill Kobe the next day. In fact, they put in a metal detector over there and Kobe jumped up and said, let's fight. Okay. And all of this has been confirmed by Shaq as recently as the All-Star game this February in Chicago and by John Black, the PR director of the Lakers, former PR director. But anyway, I called him to let him know this interview was coming out, guys, and he didn't want to respond. But for the next two or three years, he called me Trader Gray. Here comes Trader Gray, and he wouldn't talk to me. Trader Gray. So we have a great relationship now, and I love Shaq. But when you ask about what it was like to cover them, they had obviously tremendous highs with those three-peat championships, And to see that excellence of one of the greatest tandems in the history of basketball. But they also had some really, really, really low lows. And so it was always unique and interesting. And I loved Kobe. I knew Kobe from the time that he was an infant in his mother Pam's arms. I was a scout, believe it or not, guys, for the San Diego Clippers, for Paul Silas and Pete Babcock.
Wow.
So I had known Kobe as just, I'd seen Kobe grow from when his dad, Jelly Bean, played for the Clippers, and obviously my time in Philadelphia and then so forth. But still hurt and grief that loss, and it's just tragic for Vanessa and the girls and the other families. But covering them was a great joy, and it was really, really an interesting time and something that we'll never see again.
Nothing. You know, what I find interesting, obviously, is to me, knowing Kobe the way I did, and when I hear new stories, he used all the negativity as fire. Like, that's what you saw on the court. That Mamba was, he had a way of channeling all the other noise and distractions and bullshit into fire. But then at the same time, it's also amazing to hear the human side, to let people know, like, people have feelings. Like, this really wore him down. And I never knew that. And like, to me, like I said, it's just interesting, especially when you're hearing about the GOATs, but just people in general. I think often people think we're robots, that we're just straight athletes, and because we make money, nothing affects us, nothing. But it's interesting to hear the human and the emotional side of what that caused, you know, because I know I hear a lot and have been around L.A. kind of since Kobe got here. And you would hear stuff like, damn, they really did used to fuck with Kobe. You know, I heard one story one time where, and it was confirmed, that Kobe would come on the plane or the bus sometimes with his headphones on but off, just so he can kind of hear what kind of shit that Shaq was going to, you know, kind of be saying. But, you know, everyone, you might have thought they were on, but to kind of hear, you know, the human side and how that did beat him up and wear him down, but to see the finished product of what it turned him into, you know, it was pretty special.
Shaq was brutal to Kobe. Okay, he was brutal in many ways. Take all the success aside. I mean, you know, Shaq knows how to get everybody to coalesce around him. He's fun. He's engaging. He's light.
Shaq is a great. You know, I play with Shaq. I love Shaq to death. But like I said, you were around, and then hearing stories, it sounds like it was an all out attack.
Well, he knew how to recruit guys into his camp. And Kobe wasn't Kobe wasn't trying to be in anybody's camp. Kobe was trying to be the best basketball player ever and win championships. So he wasn't engaged in that type of fraternal order, or, you know, be the Pied Piper, so to speak. And so, you know, it worked against him and hurt him, but it also helped elevate him because he became stronger mentally, that Mamba mentality. And, you know, the good thing was is by the end of Kobe's life, you know, they had worked out a detente. They weren't close. They weren't the best of buddies. They didn't hang out. But, you know, they had a detente that they realized the time that they had spent together was special, that it probably had ended too soon. But Kobe went on and did what he wanted to do and proved to himself that he could be a champion with Pau Gasol and with other teammates, and to be the leader of the group instead of having, you know, Shaq make a self-declaration that it was his team. Kobe was able to prove that, no, it was in fact his team. So, and at the end of the day, you know, you probably never know how good you have it till you don't have it anymore. I mean, everybody's life is kind of riddled with
Absolutely.
That, right? All of us look back and say, you know, that was pretty good. Why did I do things like that? And I think that they had come to that, like I say, that detente where they had come back together, not close, but just not antagonized anymore.
What made Kobe, in your eyes, so special?
He cared so much. He cared. He dug into everything deeply. If he was committed, he was committed. And that meant friendship too and loyalty. He was very loyal to me. I saw his loyalty play out in numerous ways to a host of folks. And he never forgot. This guy had a memory. You talk about elephants have memories? No. Kobe's have memories. They should rename the term. This guy did not forget anything about anybody at any time. If it was an act of kindness, he always appreciated it. If it was a slight, he had it filed. He had a big cabinet, and he knew. He knew where everybody was all the time. and he had it all sorted out. So he had a great, great memory, and he could also compartmentalize. And he would use for good what worked for good for him and use for bad, as you pointed out earlier, that motivation and that fire, and it drove him. And I think the other thing that happened with Kobe is Kobe had thousands and thousands of acts of kindness, and he didn't look for recognition of it. He didn't want that acknowledgement. He didn't right. want that to go against that Mamba mentality that maybe somehow right. somebody might figure out that he had looks a softness, soft. You know, yeah. that would work right. against yeah. him.
Absolutely.
But let's remember what's the most lasting impression that we have now of Kobe Bryant. It's kissing Gigi. It's girl dad, that hashtag. It's you know, not only what he achieved on the basketball court, but it's that love that everybody has for him, what they saw off the court. And I was able to see that, you know, virtually his whole life. And so, and that's what hurts so bad, is that we don't have that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy you said that the lasting memory, because I felt the same way. I actually got that tattooed on my leg. Her at the All-Star game reaching up and giving her dad a kiss. I got that tatted on my leg about 4 months ago. So that is, at the end of the day, say what you want. To me, that's what it was for me. You know, everything else was great, but the dad he was what was so special. And that's what really our connection grew, was with kids and him sending my kids shoes and him coming to my kids' AAU games and us going to check out Gigi's games. Like, that's was my greatness aside, Mamba aside, like the human side of Kobe is what I, you know, always hold on to whenever I'm kind of feeling down about anything.
He was special. He was just special. And I get goosebumps yeah. hearing you say that about the tattoo that you have. And, you know, I knew him on, you know, just as a great, great friend. And we took a trip a few years ago, to Hong Kong, number of people in Hong Kong, some billionaires, Chinese billionaires, wanted to hear Kobe speak. And so, make a long story short, they had me come interview him. And then after this interview for like 20 people for an hour, we went to a bar in Hong Kong, and they only spoke Chinese there, except for we sang karaoke. And I just never forget that night of Kobe singing the Jay-Z song of New York with Alicia Keys, and my wife singing mm-hmm. an Elvis song, I Can't Stop Falling in Love with You. And my wife, Fran, had done the first commercial. She worked for the Coca-Cola company and did the first commercial that Kobe ever did when he was a 17, 18-year-old youngster for Sprite.
Sprite.
And she did that commercial. So they had been very close for a long time as well. And then I sang a John Denver song, believe it or not, Country Roads Take Me Home. And we were singing in this Chinese bar in
Take
Hong Kong.
Me home
Country Roads. Anyway, so at West Virginia, so it made me even think of Jerry West when I was doing it and Kobe. And I just kind of, and we were there, and there were maybe 25 or 30 people there. And his guard was totally down. And that's the Kobe that I remember. That's the Kobe that I, you know, I was exposed to. And it's the one that we miss. And it's the great thing about Kobe, as tragic as this death is, he's left an imprint, an indelible impression in our minds. And the outpouring mm-hmm. of love and respect that was shown to him and displayed is you know, really in a category and almost unsurpassed in Los Angeles that I can remember, and across the country and across the globe. And perhaps it's because of the way that he was lost with the others and his beautiful girl Gigi, and perhaps it's because that's how they felt all this time and never were able to show him while he was alive.
Right.
Mm. That's why you didn't know I knew that song advocate. On that. No, that surprised me. No, but I mean, that's why, you know, you're an advocate of giving people flowers while they're here. And it's an interesting point you touched on, Jim. I think more than anything, they knew it. They just never, you know, all the back talking and bullshit. They figured at one point, hey, I'll be able to pay my respects. But it just goes to show you never know. You know, they had these amazing feelings about him, but they disguised them with hate and bullshit instead of just saying, hey, like, we got a lot of love for you. But anyway, man, rest in peace to our brother Kobe and Gigi, yes, and obviously everyone else left lost on that flight. 2010. Tell me what it was like sitting across from LeBron James during the decision, from your point of view.
It was the most unique moment I've had probably in my career. It was the star of the NBA announcing to the league and the world his intentions. And I didn't know the answer to the question. I didn't want to know the answer to the question. And he was doing this. It was like having a press conference with only one person being able to ask the questions. And that was me for this a show to give millions upon millions of dollars to the Boys and Girls Clubs that would help change and affect the lives for the better of thousands of kids, and be able to find out where exactly LeBron was going to be playing, whether he would be staying or going elsewhere. So it was really unique. Nothing like that had ever occurred before, and might I say, nothing like that probably will ever occur again.
No, absolutely. He took a lot of heat, I guess, for the way it was done, kind of an all eyes on me situation. And whether you liked the way he made it happen or not, what I took away from it was player empowerment. You know, he showed people, for like superstars in particular, for the first time, like, this is your career. Like, do what you want to do with your career. Now, like you said, you may not have agreed with the vehicle in which he did it, but at the end of the day, what I took away from it, and you've seen the ripple effect since, as if you're a superstar, like, you know, these teams aren't loyal, at the end of the day, aren't loyal to you, and then the second you can't perform from them, they're going to cut you, trade you, or waive you. Like, take your career and your future and your plan in your own hands. And I always had a lot of respect and admiration for him when he did that day, because 10 years later, you've seen a whole new landscape of the NBA because of the decision.
That's exactly.
Even today, look, James Harden holding out. So, you know.
You hit it exactly yep. right, Matt and Jax. Exactly right. And in the rearview mirror now, 10 years, but it was the beginning of player empowerment. And I say that in talking to goats in the book, that the this was the Curt Flood moment for not only basketball players, but for players really in every sport. Of course, Curt Flood, all those years ago, challenged the reserve clause. And it was a very difficult road for him, but he paved the way for you guys. He paved the way for all athletes to be able to have the ability to be free. Okay, and he was doing it for baseball. Right. Well, what LeBron James did here was not only the beginning of player empowerment and the ability to bring super teams together. We had super teams before, but it was the organizations who had put them together. It was the organizations who had manipulated it. It was not because a certain player decided he wanted to go play with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh together that he did on his own volition. Right. It was because the organizations were able to manipulate the system and bring folks together. Or the draft worked out that David Robinson was hurt very badly one year, and they were able to get the draft pick, which turned into Tim Duncan. Well, that was more, a quirk of fate than it was any planning. There was no planning in that. It happened. It happened because one guy who was the best player, or one of the best players, David Robinson, got hurt. And I understand that we have Kevin Garnett and what happened in Boston. I get all that. But what LeBron James did, it not only was player empowerment of deciding where you were going to go, how you were going to go, and when you were going to go, it also was really the advent and the birth of this social media blossoming and boom, okay? Now everybody, that night when he took that hour from ESPN and gave the money to charity is how athletes then decided they were going to communicate without the vehicle of the PR department or without David Stern and the NBA having the ability to have the approval. They did it. He did it on his own, and he took all of the risk, and he ultimately now got all of that reward. But they made him into a villain, and the guy's never been a villain. What can you villainize about a guy who's won 4 championships? What can you villainize about a guy who's been to, 10 NBA finals? What can you villainize about a guy who's built a school, who stands up for social justice, who gets people to go out and vote, who basically has done everything right in public, okay? So now all of a sudden he had a television show to announce that he decided he wanted to go play basketball someplace else, and everybody, and I understand we could have been better. We could have done better. we could have been more sensitive to the fans in Cleveland who were deeply hurt by the best player in the league and a hometown hero from just outside in Akron leaving their team. So we could have handled that a little bit more sensitively, all of us. And you know, there are certain aspects of the show, obviously, that had quirks and flaws. But look at social media now, and look at not only that, but the Players Tribune, and how you guys in all of sports now communicate with the public. You guys are now media guys. You're moguls. You have your own platforms. Okay. Well, that really, really started. That was the commencement of it. Okay. And I think that all athletes owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to LeBron for what he had to go through to give them a better place. We now spend the majority of the year talking more about where is Kevin Garnett going to play before he even wins a championship next year. Where will Kawhi Leonard end up before he's even completed the task where he is? Where is he going next year? And some of this, not all of it's for the good, but I would say a high percentile is very much for the good. And they owe all of that to LeBron.
Yeah. I agree. And I wish, you know, as a former player and then moving into the media and media base too, but fans as well, just had an appreciation and an understanding for the moment of greatness, of not only LeBron's greatness, but of Kobe's greatness before he passed, of Steph's greatness, of Giannis's greatness. And I think too often it's cooler to hate or say something negative instead of showing appreciation, which is crazy to me. Because at the end of the day, and you touched on it with Kobe, a lot of people had admiration, but instead of showing admiration, they showed hate or despise or, you know, sneak shit, instead of just kind of realizing the moment and how special and lucky we are to be able to watch these guys do what they do at this kind of level.
I'm not sure why all that goes on. It's a mystery to me, but, Bud Greenspan said something to me a long time ago. You guys know who Bud Greenspan was? He was a guy that wore the glasses on top of his head. He's before your time. He was a great Olympian and documentarian, a historian of the Olympic Games. And he did great films like Jesse Owens Returns to Berlin and the Wilma Rudolph Story and The Last African Runner. And he won all kinds of awards, Peabody's, Emmys, everything. And he said something to me when I was young and working for him after I had done that Ali interview, and I came out to Los Angeles to work on the 84 Olympics as one of the producers on his film, 16 Days of Glory. And he said to me something that just doesn't seem to be too pervasive in our society because of the competition. And when he said it to me, I thought it was condescending and arrogant. But he said, "I knew I was good when I could look at someone else's work and admire it." I'm just not sure why people just can't look at people's work and admire it. Maybe they don't feel they're good. Mm. Maybe they don't feel that they're up to snuff. Maybe they don't feel perfect in their lives. Yeah. And maybe they just feel that by tearing down somebody else, somehow that makes them look better.
Make them feel better.
But
yeah,
it's a sad circumstance.
You never benefit from that.
It's more of a reflection on the person who's doing it. You know what I mean? And I think that's obviously the era we live in now with social media, which is unfortunate. And that's why I try to shield my kids, because they're coming into the spotlight. You know, we just launched their podcast and we have a behind the scenes show, their AAU team. And it's weird that I have to have a conversation of what's coming for them. Like, people are going to hate you for, and they're not even great. They're just their kids. But at the same time, knowing where they're going, people are going to hate you because you have something going for you. And you have to kind of understand that and not let that play with your mind. Because as a child, you know, we were fortunate enough to not really start listening to all the buzz until social media came around, but to grow up in it and to hear and constantly compared and trash talk and disrespect and hurtful things being said to a child, I think that's something you need to brace them for, because that's not something we grew up with. We didn't grow up with constant negativity at the palm of our hand.
I would agree with that. I mean, you know, it's a whole different paradigm. I mean, we used to have letters to the editor, and one letter used to represent how 1,000 people right. would feel, but that letter didn't always get printed, right. even if they had a negative feeling. Or they would call into the station and they would inundate the switchboard. You know, that happened to me with the Pete Rose interview, you know, all of the negative hate mail and all of the taunts and threats that came into the voicemails and what they did to the switchboards across the country. But the negativity of today with young kids and the bullying that goes on and the seemingly okayness, if that's a word, of this being directed at people. I think it was Mike Tyson who brilliantly said not too long ago, and I have it on my telephone because I love the quote. So,
I posted it.
I have it. I love the quote so much.
I know what you're going to say. I posted it.
Okay, well, go ahead and tell it.
I think people get too comfortable with disrespecting. It was something along those lines, right?
People have gotten way too comfortable with being able to say negative stuff about it without facing the consequence of being punched in the mouth.
Straight up. Straight up.
One thing I was taught as a younger, and this is some free game for all the youngsters out there, and it's something that I always live by. Never demean somebody for your personal gain. It's going to always backfire on you.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that.
Absolutely.
2020 Basketball Hall of Fame class, Kobe, KG, Duncan. How much do they epitomize GOATs with this Hall of Fame class?
Well, Kobe leading the way. It's an unbelievably great class, okay? And Tim Duncan is such an understated guy, but boy, was he great. Great to deal with as a professional. Just a true professional. Great to be around. Obviously a great teammate, a great champion. Just a pleasure. Kobe, obviously, we've talked about him. And, you know, who else had the dedication that Kevin Garnett gave to the game of basketball and the pursuit of excellence that he put forth? For all of those many years, and to see that rewarded, you know, after what had gone on and all that he gave to Minnesota and falling short with the Timberwolves and then coming and being able to capture that championship with the Boston Celtics and to, you know, to see, you know, just to have been able to see his story and to see what had been achieved. And then, you know, the others who are going into that class as well. It's bittersweet. It's sweet to see those guys get their day. It's bitter because of COVID and obviously without Kobe being there. I know Vanessa will be participating. I'm honored that I've been given the Kurt Gowdy Award to be able to participate, which is a tremendous thrill and honor for me to be able to get that award at the Hall of Fame with Kobe and the others, that Mike Breen also getting it, and the gang from Turner, Ernie Johnson, and Charles Barkley, and their show going in with Kenny Smith and Shaq. So it's a great class, and are you going to get any better than those three? And the others who will be with them, Tamika yeah. Catchings. Look at everything that she was able to achieve, and the other Hall of Famers. So, unfortunately, it wasn't able to happen back in August, and it'll happen now in the second week, I believe, of May is when we'll all go to Springfield and Mohegan Sun and have that ceremony before the class of 2021 will go in later in the summer.
Congratulations to you as well.
Thank you.
All right, absolutely. In case you guys missed it, I mean, you're going in the Hall of Fame as well. You're 2020 Hall of Fame, obviously on the media side, but it just goes to show just your body of work has been rewarded as it should be, and how much, as someone who played the game and got a chance to interact with you, and now someone who's in the media space as well, how much we respect and look up to you and appreciate what you've done, not only for the game, but showing other media outlets how you should handle and deal and actually build friendships with athletes. Because like I said, it's at the very beginning of the interview, it's very rare to have friendships, and you have been friendships and great relationships with some of the greatest to ever play any game.
Well, thank you. And that's what's meant the most to me. It's the relationship. You know, I just heard, you know, you obviously have children. My wife and I don't have children. So our friends are our family. And so when you are able to have these friendships and these relationships with guys, you know, there's tremendous meaning in it. And that doesn't mean that you don't do your job. And that doesn't mean that I haven't asked all of these guys questions that needed to be asked. Right. A lot of times they say, well, is that a conflict? Well, what's the conflict? I've asked everybody who's been in front of me what I thought should be asked for the people I work with and for the audience. And somebody asked me about that at the Hall of Fame, the Boxing Hall of Fame, a couple of years ago with Mike Tyson and I. And I said, look, Mike Tyson just got hit in the head 150 times by Evander Holyfield. Tom Brady just got sacked 5 times by Michael Strahan. Kobe Bryant's been elbowed, his feet are stepped on, he's been knocked to the ground 18 times. Do you really think there's any question that I ask him that he's going to be offended by, or somehow you think that will affect our relationship? If that was the case, how could they have ever competed in the game that just transpired? They couldn't do it. Right. So Of course you ask the questions that are necessary, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a relationship with somebody or that you can't be able to, have empathy for them and compassion for them when they win, lose, or joy. Either way, any of those feelings. So the relationships, I think, as you guys will attest now that you're out of basketball, isn't that what you've taken with you now as you carry on in your life?
Yes.
Yep. Absolutely.
That's the big reason for our success.
I was about to say, that's why we're here now, is what we formed as players. So I completely
And that's why
understand.
Everybody comes on your show. They don't come on your show because they can't stand you. They come on your show because you have a relationship with you.
Right.
Agreed. Home stretch, quick hitters. First thing to come to mind, we'll start it off with the best fight you ever covered.
Castillo Corrales and Hagler Hearns.
Ooh.
Castillo Corrales, yeah, Castillo Corrales.
On Showtime, that was unbelievable. And Diego Corrales, rest his soul, had the greatest response to a question that I've asked. I said, how would you describe this fight? He said, this fight was an honor.
Big time.
Hell of a fight. Best NBA moment covered.
Wow. I was personally thrilled for Julius Erving at the time to win that championship. And then obviously to see Michael Jordan's final shot as a Bull, that was great. And then to have been at that Dream Team practice in Monte Carlo to see the best game that nobody unfortunately ever got to see. So I would say that even though that wasn't an NBA moment, those three, and to have Chuck Daly win a championship as my best friend and as I stated earlier, introduced me to my wife and just was such a dear close pal to see him win that championship
Rest
with the Pistons. Yeah, that was special, particularly after the disappointment of losing in the Boston Garden and Isaiah throwing away the ball and then losing to Pat Riley in the Lakers the year before in that Game 7. So I would say those four things, two of them really personal and two of them just huge events in the history of basketball.
Favorite interview?
Well, I probably would say my favorite
interview. I know that's a tough one.
I would say the first one with Ali and the ear biting with Tyson.
Wow. We didn't get to get into that, but that would have been awesome.
Five GOAT dinner guests.
So around the table, a nice bottle of wine. Who are you? Who are five people you're having at your table?
Human beings or sports?
No, human no, people. People. Yeah, whoever.
Any five dinner any guests human. You want.
Yep. Nelson Mandela, who I did have a meal with.
Yes.
He was the most remarkable and special man I ever met. Winston Churchill.
Nice.
Because of obvious reasons. Muhammad Ali, because he makes everything so much fun, and he would have just had everybody laughing and, would have even with those folks been probably the center of attention. My dad, because he was my hero, and I'm going to come back to that last guest before we finish. I want to think about that for a second. maybe Dr. King, because he was so prevalent. Maybe President Kennedy, because that was so traumatic in my childhood to see both of them assassinated. Would have been kind of cool, I think, to be able to have a conversation with them and understand more about them and learn from them. You could get into religious figures, would be interesting to have them as well. So, I know I'd have those four and I'll come back to the fifth.
All right. Who would you like to see on our show? And if you know them personally, we would love your help getting them.
I'd like to see Barack Obama on your show.
Good. Hey, you a goat for a reason, man. A goat for a reason.
Because he loves basketball, and I think he would enjoy what you guys have to ask him. I don't know I don't have any influence, unfortunately, on the former president, other than I've interviewed him before a few times. But I think if you put out your feelers and you guys know how to connect, he's a basketballaholic and
indeed.
A golfaholic.
Absolutely.
So I think that'd be a great
thank
gift
you.
For you.
This has been a very special interview today, man. I've enjoyed every second. I was hypnotized by some of your stories. We appreciate all, like we said earlier, all you've done in this space and continued success. best wishes for you and your wife and your mom as well, recovering from cancer. So thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. And we're going to have six guests. I'd bring along you, Matt, and you, Mr. Jackson. That would be the rest of the dinner. Nice. Let's do it.
Man, that's an honor, man. It's an honor.
Yes. All right. Hey, well, that's a wrap. That's another edition of All the Smoke. Thank you to our guest, the legendary Jim Gray, going into the Hall of Fame in the 2020. Good luck with that. You can catch us on Showtime Basketball YouTube and the iHeart platform Black Effects. We'll see y'all next time.
This is All the Smoke, a production of the Black Effect and iHeart Radio in partnership with Showtime.